Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.4. Last time we examined the period between November 1953 to March 55, in a bid to demonstrate how the British came to be in the situation they endured with Egypt, right before Suez blew up in their face, and of course, why Anthony Eden remained somewhere near the centre of it all. After living in Churchill's shadow for so many years, ever since he first took up the post of Foreign Secretary in the 30s, it was now up to Eden to take the helm of the Conservative Party, and after a short campaign, the leadership of the country. While we have seen some of Eden's less favourable qualities, to the public he was known as an arch anti-appeaser, a man of good, stern morals, and a steady hand to guide Britain in these troubling, uncertain times. The Conservative landslide amidst a backpedalling and tired Labour Party must be put down at least partially to the image of reliability that Eden represented. Once in charge, he could shape Britain in his own image, and more importantly to Eden, he would have a handle on the country's foreign policy without Churchill looking over his shoulder for the first time. As Eden was to discover, though, the shadow of Churchill was not so easy to dispel as he had hoped. Let's see how he got on then, as I now take you to spring 1955. Before we get into the episode, I want to just share with you a little bit of audio. This is the audio of a newsreel, which is freely available on YouTube, that covers the resignation of Winston Churchill in spring 1955. Have a listen to it, guys, and we'll return afterwards.
Of Sir Winston Churchill as Prime Minister. That morning, crowds gathered in Downing Street to try to catch a glimpse of the great Englishman. For the last time, the cabinet is summoned by the man who had led us to victory in the war. Sir Anthony Eden was there, Sir Winston's right-hand man for so long, he was now to be his successor. Colleagues he had inspired in office came to take their farewells. Some had not been born when he first entered Parliament. Many were in swaddling clothes when he first became a cabinet minister. The crowd watches the ministers leave, sad-faced at the parting. It is 15 years since Sir Winston first came to number 10. Now he relinquishes the role of Her Majesty's first minister. Characteristic cigar clutched in his hand, the evergreen man of 80 years and 4 months sets out to tender his resignation to the young queen. The man who in 1940 had said that he had nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears and sweat, has paid his part of the bargain in full. It has always been been Sir Winston's habit when Prime Minister to have an audience of the Queen on Tuesday nights at Buckingham Palace. But this is the last. Now, the man who through the darkest days of the war would report regularly to the Sovereign all the great affairs of state, all the triumphs and all the failures, is no longer Prime Minister. The night before, he had been host to the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh at No. 10 Downing Street. He wears the sash of the Garter. When he was made a Knight of the Order in 1953, he became only the sixth commoner this century to be so honoured. King George VI had offered it to him in 1945, but he had then asked leave to decline it. Sir Winston took an important part in the ceremonies attending the coronation, and has probably been nearer to the Sovereign than any Prime Minister for many years. In proposing her health at the dinner, he spoke of the brilliant opening of the Queen's reign, and called her the young, gleaming champion of the wise and kindly way of life. Over 30 guests attended the dinner, many of them colleagues who had served with him in the war. The statesman who had served as a subaltern in the reign of the Queen's great-great-grandmother, and who had served in political office or parliament in the five reigns since, has his last public leave-taking of the Queen as Prime Minister.
Princes don't always have to like their kingly fathers, and political successors by no means have to like their predecessors. Churchill and Eden fit this cliché perfectly. Churchill was the Hanoverian king who despised his son, or he was Frederick William of Prussia making way for Frederick the Great, the son and heir which he needed, but which he could not stand. Churchill's private secretary recalled that Churchill harboured a cold hatred of Eden, who, Churchill repeatedly said, had done more to thwart him and prevent him pursuing the policy he thought right than anybody else. If it seems surprising that Churchill would give up the premiership on the 5th of April 1955 to a man he seems to have profoundly disliked, then the succession here was one of the rare instances in his career where Churchill thought more with his head than with his heart. Considering the ranks of the Conservatives, there was nobody with the same pedigree as Anthony Eden. There were several political climbers, as the next few years would show, but Churchill knew talent and potential when he saw it, and however begrudgingly he relinquished the post to his successor, he knew that it was necessary if his beloved party was to overcome that key challenge, representing the Tories in the looming election and preventing another Labour government from taking shape at this critical time in British history. The war was over, but Churchill looked at Britain's responsibility and his role in leading the nation no differently in 1955 than when he had first taken up the premiership on the 10th of May 1940. The first day of reaching the top of the greasy pole is certainly up there with the worst days any British Prime Minister had ever had. On the 10th of May 1940, the Nazi advance was just beginning its bulldoze into the Low Countries, which were all destined to fold in a matter of days. Further troubles abounded as the unthinkable occurred, and within weeks, France was desolated with her power destroyed. High drama had followed with Lord Halifax, the British Foreign Secretary, representing the element of British opinion which said that Britain should seek a mediated peace with Hitler through Mussolini as a go-between. The what-ifs abound over the summer of 1940, but what isn't up for debate was how pivotal Churchill was to the shaping of British policy, to the inspiring of British resistance, and the empowering of the island, which, any day now, Hitler believed, would have to throw in the towel. We cannot possibly grasp the significance of the 5th of April 1955 unless we appreciate just how monumental a figure Churchill was. As more time passed, the legend of "we shall fight on the beaches" would and could only grow. Churchill knew this, and he also knew that he wanted to remain in the premiership and that he dreaded retirement for so many reasons. Evelyn Shuckburgh was a rising star in the Foreign Office and was also Anthony Eden's private secretary. He happened to have a good relationship with a lady called Jane Portal, who was also one of the most closely connected people to old Winnie, as she saw him every day to help construct his daily diary. Jane Portal was, in many respects, the unsung hero in at least this portion of Churchill's career. Like many who enjoyed close relations with Churchill
and didn't have to politically compete with him, she was immensely fond of him. Schuckburg recalled a conversation he had with Jane Portal shortly before Churchill resigned, saying, "She, Jane Portal, now admits that the old boy whom she loves dearly is getting senile and failing more and more each day. She says that he is open to constant influence and is easily stirred up by his entourage. Life is a misery to him. He half kills himself with work, cannot take in the papers he is given to read, and can hardly get up the stairs to bed. Yet he thinks he has a mission on three subjects, Russia, the atomic bomb, and Egypt. It is impossible for him to resign because he can no longer write, he dreads solitude and oblivion, and he fears rest, but he will soon die." In fact, Churchill would hang on for another decade, but he knew deep down that his days at the helm of the party were over. At one point, Eden had been tipped to succeed to the helm of the party in the late 1930s, and had he not resigned after Munich, and had the war not broken out, Anthony Eden may well have been British Prime Minister during the 1940s. Considering the fact that without the war, Churchill would never have been allowed to shine in the way that he did, Eden would have been given a real opportunity to demonstrate himself as a steady, experienced hand with seldom a blemish on his record, which was more than one could say for the firebrand Churchill, who had led British and Empire forces to disaster at Gallipoli. The setbacks of the last two decades faded away, though, when, on the 6th of April 1955, Anthony Eden went to Buckingham Palace to receive royal approval for his appointment as Prime Minister. The best policy, he was assured, was to capitalise on the nostalgia created by the departure of Churchill by calling a snap election. Winston Churchill's last accomplishment, whether he had intended it or not, was to pave the way for the most successful Conservative Party election since 1935, as the Tories were swept to victory. Part of the success must be attributed to Eden, though. Posters of his weathered but still handsome face adorned many a wall with the message that he was working for peace, since at this stage, at least, he was. "Anthony deserves his turn," became a kind of rallying cry, as Eden's shiny pre-war record once more stood to him and represented him as a courageous man of great integrity who would be expected to stand up for British interests while keeping Britain out of any messy foreign entanglements. Eden's appeal was made up with a variety of factors, some of which were contradictory. In the first place, he hearkened back to an era before the war, when Britain's empire remained the largest in the world, when national debt didn't occupy one's talk of the economy, and when more options and grounds for optimism seemed to exist in the world. That Britain had virtually broken itself to defeat the Nazis was not yet wholly understood or accepted, as it would be today. Those that Eden appealed to because of his representation of an old order were also roused by his pledge to commit to peace. Britain could be both steeped in an imperial glory and refrain from taking part in any foreign wars or any messier wars of decolonization. Eden suggested, in short, that Britons could have it both ways, but this impression did not, and indeed could not, last. The first sign that things wouldn't be plain sailing came from Eden's choice of cabinet. Since Eden gave off the impression that he was a new leader for the Tories, while also representing its glorious past at the same time, it shouldn't surprise us too much to note that some older faces from the 1930s remained in top positions. Harold Macmillan was taken from the Ministry of Defence and just plonked into the Foreign Office. Almost immediately, Macmillan felt himself at home, and he set about crafting an intelligent foreign policy. Since Eden was himself rather occupied with the question of foreign policy, he would soon learn to regret placing the headstrong Macmillan in this position, as we'll see. Yet a fresh face did appear in Macmillan's old Ministry of Defence, a Mr. Selwyn Lloyd. Lloyd lacked a great deal of experience, and tended to defer to Eden, which irritated the Prime Minister at first, but soon Eden saw the advantage. If Lloyd was out of his depth in the Defence Ministry, then imagine how rudderless and in need of Eden's help he would be in the Foreign Ministry. He would be so clueless, Anthony Eden could practically run the foreign policy of the country as he desired. This thought process seems to have played a major role in Eden's decision to replace Macmillan in the Foreign Ministry with Selwyn Lloyd, less than a year after making this cabinet shuffle. This change is very important for our story, because while Harold Macmillan would never have let himself be pushed around, and may well have avoided the Suez Crisis altogether, Selwyn Lloyd was a disciple of Eden's and proved utterly incapable of forming his own policy. But Zach, surely it doesn't matter too much that Eden went on to appoint a non-entity in the foreign ministry, since he wasn't as much of a firebrand as Churchill had been, and surely Eden would in general lead a less reactionary policy. If Eden hadn't changed the stance which won him so many votes in April 1955, then this would be the case. However, with Churchill's departure, an unavoidable fact became apparent to Anthony Eden. Churchill may have been gone, but Eden led a Tory government which was a mirror image of the men who had once constituted the Conservative governments of the glory days. In his cabinet of 18 men, for instance, 9 of them had been to Eton, and 16 were scions of either Cambridge or Oxford. If Eden's government was little better than a club of middle-aged or elderly gentlemen who still kept barking on about how great things used to be, it was inevitable that Eden's tenure and his shortcomings should be compared to those of Churchill. Eden did not do well under this comparison. How could anyone when compared to the greatest living Englishman? To compensate for his growing inferiority complex, the once steady foreign secretary became, as prime minister, almost more reactionary than Churchill had been. Domestic politics at home, and the trends of his peers' opinions, affected in Eden a change of character which was to impact severely upon British foreign policy. Since the transforming Anthony Eden created a solution whereby he could have control over the foreign ministry, it was especially significant that matters progressed as they did. Looking back retrospectively on British domestic and foreign politics in the 18 months or so between Eden's appointment as Prime Minister and the eruption of the Suez Crisis, it is impossible to ignore what went on behind closed doors in the British political establishment. Different figures, had they been in place, would never have allowed matters to progress as they did. Yet, much like Benjamin Disraeli had discovered 3 generations before, the reshaping of Conservative identity, or rather, the reshaping of his own political identity and legacy, was immensely difficult to achieve without some measure of foreign intervention. In Benjamin Disraeli's case, he was blocked or outmaneuvered by the stalwart foreign policy director, Lord Derby. But Eden suffered from no such restrictions. After living in Churchill's shadow for so long, Eden perhaps never completely realised that he had adopted the shadow as his own. It was as though the old man had never left, and Churchill's out-of-touch ramblings still led Conservative policy. Eden's control over foreign policy was made possible by Selwyn Lloyd's appointment in late 1955 to the position of Foreign Secretary. Harold Macmillan, the man who Eden by now identified as his political rival, and in fact the man who would succeed him as Prime Minister in 1957, was disgusted to be removed from the post where he was settling into nicely and to be shipped off to the unfamiliar Treasury Office instead. Harold Macmillan was out of the way, and Eden was rightly pleased, but Selwyn Lloyd was just as unfamiliar and unsuited to the Foreign Ministry as Macmillan was with the Treasury. An almost hilarious recounting of Selwyn Lloyd's unlikely rise through the ranks of the Foreign Office deserves to be recorded here, if only to show the very arbitrary way in which new appointments were handed down, whether one wanted them or not. In fact, it would have made far more sense to put Lloyd in the Treasury and keep Macmillan where he was, as Lloyd testified when he remembered Churchill's placing of him in the Foreign Office as a junior minister in 1951, where his career in the Foreign Office began, plainly against his wishes. As Selwyn Lloyd himself recalled, "All my activity had been with dealing with the finance bill, fighting the budgets as Secretary of the Conservative Finance Committee, and I expected to go to the Treasury. Then I got a message that I was to go down to Chartwell to see Mr. Churchill. When I got there, Churchill said, 'We haven't seen much of each other, but I hear well of you, and I want you to be Minister of State at the Foreign Office.' I really could have been knocked over with the proverbial feather, because it had never entered my head. So I said, 'But, sire, I think there must be some mistake. I've never been to a foreign country except in war. I don't speak any foreign language. I don't like foreigners.' That was a view which I later changed. 'I've never spoken in a foreign affairs debate. I've never been listened to one.' Churchill said, 'Young man, those all seem to me to be positive advantages.' And he told me to go to the Foreign Office where Mr. Eden was waiting for me. A friend had lent me a car with a driver, and we went up to London and I said, 'Take me to the Foreign Office.' My driver said, 'Where is it, sir?' And I suddenly realised that I didn't know. So we had to stop off in Whitehall and Ask a policeman. Selwyn Lloyd was not the first, and would by no means be the last individual appointed to an office totally out of his comforts and expertise. Yet considering the time frame, the changing domestic political situation in Britain, and the worsening situation abroad, Selwyn Lloyd must stand as one of the most untimely of figures to hold the position when he was appointed to lead the office he didn't understand in late December 1955. Of course, Anthony Eden's ulterior motive for appointing Lloyd, nicknamed unflatteringly by the Labour backbenchers as Eden's office boy, was to ensure that the Prime Minister could also hold the reins of the country's foreign policy. William Hayter, Britain's ambassador to the Soviet Union and a highly respected diplomat in his own right, recalled the scene when he stopped by to meet with Selwyn Lloyd shortly after his appointment as Foreign Secretary. Hayter said, "If I came on leave at that time, it was Eden who I used to go and see. I pay a formal call on Selwyn Lloyd, but it was Eden I would talk to. It was clear that Selwyn Lloyd had no personal initiative and was entirely under Eden's thumb, who had complete control as far as I could see. Eden had almost forgotten that he wasn't Foreign Secretary. On the whole, the Foreign Office is an obedient department. It does what the Foreign Secretary wants it to do, and it was clear at this time that the Foreign Secretary was the Prime Minister."
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
With his own hand over the Foreign Office, Eden implemented his plans to solve the problems posed by that Egyptian colonel, Gamal Abdel Nasser, by sending a diplomat on a personal tour of the Middle East and North Africa with a bid to find some solutions to our many problems, as Eden put it. This diplomat, Robin Turton, unearthed a great deal of unsettling information during his stay in Cairo, including details of a Soviet-Egyptian arms deal. With such arms, Nasser could initiate the war with Israel, which now appeared imminent. Nasser was all charms and smiles in his talks with Robin Turton, though, and he assured the Brit that Egypt had no plans for a war with Israel. What Nasser said he did want was to revolutionize the Egyptian economy and bring the country into the developed world. The key to this mission, Nasser believed, was to modernize the way Egyptians lived their lives. It was time, Nasser said, to master the forces of the Nile and harness them for his own use. The Aswan High Dam was by no means the first project which aimed at the control of the Nile's seasonal flooding and the reclaiming of hundreds of thousands of acres of desert. A successful building would have to be 350 feet high, 3 miles wide, and create an artificial lake 300 miles long. The act would reclaim 1.3 million acres of desert, as well as improving the agricultural potential of a further 700,000 acres. 2 million acres in all would be able to be turned over to productive farmland. The dam's resulting power could also be used to provide hydroelectric energy for new industries, It seemed a win-win, and indeed it was. It was essential, after all, if Egypt was to make full use of its resources and end the seasonally disruptive problems which the flooding caused. The key problem was, of course, the sheer cost. The estimate for the building of the dam was placed at $1.3 billion, which Nasser attempted to raise through the calling of old favours and contacts, but above all, through his new friends in the CIA. The United States government, the World Bank, and even the British themselves proved amenable to give grants and loans to Nasser, likely on the understanding that they would gain some kind of leverage over Egypt in return. A consortium of European construction firms were contracted to carry out the work, and these people began to arrive in spring 1956. Yet, Nasser's problems began when he tried to do several things at once. Not only did he want to build a dam, he also wanted to improve his country's military capabilities through new arms deals. Rumours that the Soviets would step into this role had moved President Eisenhower to approve an arms deal worth $27 billion in mid-June 1955, but problems had quickly emerged with the deal. Nasser first offered to pay in cotton for the arms, but since the United States was drowning in cotton of its own, and since Egyptian cotton was the country's most valuable commodity, the negotiations hit something of a wall. Nasser was immensely suspicious of any obligations or terms which accompanied such a deal, and when the Americans responded to the cotton offer with a line of credit offer instead, Nasser felt his back go up against the wall. The idea that America would possess such a stake in Egypt recalled all too easily the considerable British stake in the country, which was still floating in the Suez Canal Company. Nasser may well have been oversensitive to American terms, since he was asking for a great deal without having any real means to pay after all, but his delivery of an ultimatum of sorts to the American ambassador, taking the form of a declaration that if the United States wouldn't sell, he'd look to the Soviets, set off alarm bells in Washington. Events moved quickly after this. Throughout September 1955, as Anthony Eden was coming to terms with his new cabinet arrangements and eyeing up Macmillan nervously in the Foreign Office, the Americans opened a diplomatic channel with the British regarding the Egyptian situation. The British then slid into what Nasser must have intercepted as the nauseatingly two-faced approach they had always adhered to, the strategy of pledging friendship to Egypt while also handing out threats. In Nasser's mind, the Anglo-American consultation over Egypt was also a breach of confidence, and he switched his mission to that of getting arms off the Soviets rather than from the West. On the 27th of September 1955, the new British ambassador in Cairo, Sir Humphrey Trevelyan, called on Nasser alongside the key figures of the CIA office. They found the Egyptian leader insecure and convinced that the Israelis were planning an attack. So concerned did Nasser seem that Israel possessed military superiority that he proclaimed himself willing to do what was necessary and ask the Soviets for terms. Nasser insisted to the Anglo-American deputation that this didn't mean he would allow the Soviets to stay, but that since the West wouldn't help him, he would have to find someone who would. The British began backtracking on their pledge to help finance the Aswan Dam at the news of Nasser's looming arms deal, but the Americans still believed they could change Nasser's mind. By late 1955, though, the United States was losing the battle for Egyptian hearts and minds, largely because of the perceived unequal treatment given to Egypt by the United States in comparison to America's relationship with Israel. Such was to be expected. There was, after all, no Egyptian lobby to Congress and no history of Egyptian participation in the United States which could match the country's Jewish activism. Nasser was far more well-informed than the Anglo-American group seems to have anticipated. He was informed, for example, that the French had dealt substantial arms shipments to Israel at knockdown prices and were soon to forge a full-blown alliance, and that Washington had done nothing to stop this. In addition, even the way in which American charities were set up irked Nasser. It was known, for example, that American charities operating outside of the mainland could give grants to Israel which were exempt from tax. Egyptians enjoyed no such privileges, nor, considering the history and experiences of the United States, could they have expected to. Yet to Nasser, it didn't matter so much that America would always be on better terms with Israel than with him. What mattered was that Washington and, of course, the CIA claimed repeatedly to be his friend when behind the scenes they were helping to undermine his regime. Nasser told the Americans as much when they visited him again shortly thereafter, as John Foster Dulles sent another travelling diplomat to Cairo, since Eisenhower was recuperating from a heart attack he had just had. The American diplomat, which had been sent, was forced to wait for over an hour before seeing Nasser, a humiliating and often used diplomatic tactic which American representatives at this point in history were certainly not accustomed to. Nasser then subjected the American to a long diatribe, after which point Dulles was informed, and he let the British hear it. On the 30th of October 1955, Yvonne Kirkpatrick in the British Foreign Office advised Eden and the Americans to play up the Russian card to Nasser for all it was worth. In a winding memorandum which captured a great deal of events in the region, Kirkpatrick said, "The Russians have deliberately elected to open a new Cold War front in the Middle East. Egypt is the largest of the Arab states, and no Western policy in the Middle East which is actively opposed by Egypt will be entirely satisfactory. An effort should be made to prevent Egypt falling completely under Russian domination. If this fails, we must try ruthlessly to isolate Egypt. In the meantime, we must try to prevent the uncommitted Arab states from joining the Egypt-Syria-Saudi coalition. Finally, we must recognise that it is the Israel-Arab conflict which has weakened Western influence in the Middle East and opened the door to Russia. If we wish to maintain a position of influence with the Arabs, we must bring the conflict to an end as soon as possible. This means strong pressure on Israel and also on those Arab states in which we still have influence." Characteristically, this call to action was not accompanied by any practical advice about how such ends could be achieved. Yet, as the Aswan Dam continued to be discussed, the question of whether the pledges of Western finances for this project could be used as leverage began to swirl around. As London and Washington thoughtfully stroked their chins about what to do next, Nasser eagerly awaited the arrival of his arms shipments from the Soviets, which arrived in full by the middle of June 1956. Considering what followed in that year, it is worth detailing briefly exactly what Nasser got. The delivery consisted of 100 MiG fighters, 300 medium and heavy tanks, over 100 self-propelled guns, 200 armoured personnel carriers, 2 destroyers, 4 minesweepers, 20 motor torpedo boats, 500 pieces of artillery, and rocket launchers, bazookas, and radio with radio equipment. While the Soviets were pledging this hardware, the Anglo-Americans, cooperating with the World Bank, were still pledging their money for the building of the dam. The Anglo-Americans would loan Nasser $70 million in grants and would help negotiate a $200 million loan from the World Bank, in addition to a singular $130 million loan from the United States and a similarly negotiated $80 million loan from the British, each to be repaid over 15 years. One could ask why the Anglo-Americans were helping Nasser finance his dam when Nasser seemed to be acting against their interests and accepting Soviet arms. In John Foster Dulles' mind, he saw that helping Nasser with the dam would signal to the Egyptian leader that the Anglo-American bloc did have Egyptian interests at heart. Yet, the more practical reason was found in Dulles' not unreasonable belief that the construction of the dam would occupy Nasser and prevent him from engaging in a reckless foreign policy while the dam was being made. Finally, there was the added fear that if the West didn't finance the dam, the Soviets would, and thus Moscow would ratchet up its influence in Cairo to an unbearable degree. The price may well have been astronomical to all sides, but in Washington and London, for the moment at least, this price seemed worth paying. This moment, indeed, was not to last. It wasn't so much Nasser's inconsistency as opposition at home, which unnerved both governments in their financial support of the dam. Critics of the massive loans reasoned with justification that since Egypt's defence budget was now equal to a quarter of its yearly expenditure, there was no guarantee that the sums given would not simply be siphoned off to the defence ministry as the dam was delayed and delayed over the years. There was indeed no guarantee against this development, save for Colonel Nasser's apparent fierce determination to construct the dam. This vocal opposition led both the Americans and the British to just not talk about the problem when they met in Washington in late January 1956. The Aswan Dam was barely mentioned as the President and Dulles conversed with Eden and Selwyn Lloyd. The Americans were notably cool on the suggestion that they could do anything to restrict the Israelis or hamper the Egyptians. 1956, after all, was election year for Eisenhower, and he intended to win. Eden and Lloyd returned from this inconclusive meeting from Washington and did their best to dress it up, but critics at home saw through the lie. One such critic, who had become increasingly vocal since the resignation of Winston Churchill, was the grand old man's son Randolph, in spite of the fact that Eden was married to his cousin. Randolph Churchill noted, "The Washington Conference has failed to produce any result which could not have been procured through normal diplomatic channels. This was made abundantly plain by a pompous declaration and uninformative communique. When the statesman and politician can't think of anything else to say, they always drag in God. Last night's declaration did it twice over, both in preamble and in conclusion. It was obvious from the start of the conference that, as no planning had been done by either side, no joint plan could be produced. The declaration and the communique were full of pious platitudes and impeccable opinions." Randolph Churchill was very far from the sole critic. Eden would have been aware that his honeymoon period had sharply ended, and one merely had to throw a stone to find a negative or critical opinion about his premiership. The papers were definitely at it, with the Daily Telegraph noting in some detail that "there is a favourable gesture of the Prime Minister's. To emphasise a point, he will clench one fist to smack the open palm of the other hand, but the smack is seldom heard. Most Conservatives and almost some of the wiser trade union leaders are waiting to feel the smack of firm government." The Daily Mail also bit down when it added, "The many events are wrapped up in uncertainty and indecisiveness. There are a few hard and fast decisions. The government's trouble seems to be not paralysis so much as lack of will." Anthony Eden was certainly not twiddling his thumbs, so why was there a perception that his government was lacking in firmness? Eden would probably have claimed that it was because he was being unfairly compared with Churchill, and that this was a different time. Yet it was fair to say that at home, the details which bored Eden, like the issue of trade unions and national debt, had become problems which he neglected to solve. Inflation was on the rise, and middle-class Britons were seeing their spending powers cut as taxation seemed to increase. All Britons heard of their country's foreign policy, if they heard anything, was the lacklustre performance of their diplomatic initiatives, particularly in the Middle East, where the Baghdad Pact had manifestly failed to preserve British influence or prestige in the region. On the 6th of January 1956 issue of the Spectator, where Randolph Churchill was known to possess a column, criticism was levelled unflinchingly at Eden's failings in this regard, as it was noted that, "Judged by the only test of a policy, success in the creation of a stable system, British diplomacy in the Middle East has failed lamentably since last May, for all the hopes pinned to the Baghdad Pact, and this failure is symptomatic of a lack of nerve in high places. The instruments of British policy are some power, some moral authority, and, necessarily in a dangerous world, a great deal of skill and forethought. It is terrifying to think what extent this last essential has been lacking from the direction of our affairs in the last 9 months." We must remember that Eden was a statesman of the old school, when the nation's policy and the actions of the government were not once held up so openly for ridicule. Eden believed it damaged his reputation abroad to be so lambasted at home, and he became still less patient and a great deal more highly strung as a result. This didn't help his health, of course, which only further limited him. So bad did his health become that it even became ammunition for some jokes of bad taste among his peers, far away from Eden's ears, of course. During one occasion, when a round table of farmers were discussing the great success of the newly developed plague, myxomatosis, which was wiping out Britain's enormous rabbit population to the delight of frustrated farmers, a joke did the rounds. "I'm very worried about this myxomatosis. You don't think there's any chance of Anthony Eden catching it?" As Evelyn Shuckburgh, Eden's private secretary, noted, the dominant preoccupation was Eden's ill health. During an operation to remove his gallbladder, Eden's bile duct was damaged, which required the prescription, apparently, of amphetamines. This prescription caused mood swings, bouts of high energy and great crashes, aggressive outbursts and hyperactivity, hardly good side effects for the Prime Minister of Britain to have to endure. Whispers around Eden suggested that he had let the party down, that he couldn't handle the strain of leadership, and that even as early as mid-January 1956, he would soon resign, only a few months after having been appointed to the position. The historian Barry Turner captured the situation when he wrote, By the spring of 1956, Anthony Eden was vulnerable, criticised unfavourably and often unfairly in the Tory party as a poor substitute for Churchill, losing support in the country, according to a Gallup poll in the 6 months up to March 1956, the Prime Minister's approval rating fell from 70% to 40%. He was unable to rely on his senior colleagues, who at best were unreliable team players, and he failed to understand, let alone solve, the economic problems that beset the country. Eden let his frustration and anger show all too obviously. Knocking back the painkillers and energy boosters along with a generous intake of alcohol did not help to steady his personality. Without question, he was not the politician to cope with a crisis, but he was in prime condition to create one. Next time, we'll see what Eden did or did not do to create such a crisis, as our analysis of the Egyptian situation continues. Until then, my lovely history friends and patrons, my name is Zach, and this has been 1956 episode 2.4. Thanks for listening, thanks for paying your $5 a month, I super appreciate it, and I'll be seeing you all soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.